The first pasuk, and now parasha, Vayar Balak ben Sipor, et kol asher asa Yisrael la'emori. It says Balak, the king of Moab, saw something. What did he see? Vayar Balak, he saw something. He saw what the Jews did to the Emori. Who was the Emori? They were a nation that we read about in last week's parasha, that we decimated. We went to war against them, and we destroyed the entire Emori, and we inherited their land. Balak saw this, and he said, if they did that to the Emori, we're next. Which means, you know, what stops the Jewish armies from coming to our section? So Balak started to get nervous. Balak started to get scared. Only question that you have to ask is, hold it, Balak, you saw half a story. Yes, you saw Am Yisrael fight the Emori. You saw Bnei Yisrael decimate their armies. But you paid no attention that we only did it in self-defense. We were not the aggressors in that war. On the contrary, if you remember last week's parasha, we went to the Emori and said, please, we want to cross your country peacefully. We don't want to fight. We'll pay for the water. We'll pay for all the food. We're going to help your economy. Just let us pass. We won't go with munitions. And what did the Emori do? They came along in an offensive attack, and they came. We were passive, and they came and waged war against us. And what does Balak see? Balak sees it in a skewed vision. Balak says, look at those Jews, those warmongers. They're going and fighting against an innocent nation of Sihon. Look at the way Balak twisted history. Look at the way he twisted the situation. We might say that Balak was involved in propaganda. And that is the same propaganda 2,000 years later that the anti-Semites of the world, whether it's the different news agencies like CNN and the likings, or the different publications like the New York Times, that see history with the same vision that Balak saw it. In our history, the Arabs tried to destroy our nation at least in three official wars. In 1948, in 1967, in 1973, they tried it again in the 90s during the Persian Gulf, where they scudded us 39 times. It's clear who the aggressor was in these wars. But if you look at the media, that's not the way they see it. They see it as the Israeli army. They look at it as the Jews are picking on an innocent people, Palestinians, miskinim, people without a home. Why are the Jews doing to them to this? It's tantamount to what the Nazis did to them. And they make all these sorts of convoluted connections, turning the tables and making us the bad guys and the Arabs the good guys. During 1948, we didn't start the war. Five Arab nations came against us and threatened our existence. We were only defending ourselves. Happens to be, we were able to conquer a lot of borders. And what did they say? Look what they're doing. These are people that are power hungry. Look what they're coming, taking all the borders. We wanted to take these borders. In 1967, did we want to take the Sinai? We were thrown into the war. In the Six-Day War, all the nations again came against us. And if we didn't go on a preemptive strike, there would be no Am Yisrael v'Eretz Yisrael today. Again, that preemptive strike was defensive. But how did the world see it? Look at the Israelis. In 6 days they come, they take over other countries, they decimate armies. And they did the same thing during the Persian Gulf. During the Persian Gulf, when they interviewed the former deputy minister of Iraq, Nassimov Zikro, Tariq Aziz, Tariq Disease. And they said the former, because they deposed him. And they interview him on one of the news networks. You know, what does he think of the war that America is levying against Iraq at the time? And his answer is, the Israeli aggressor. The Israeli aggressor? We are not even allowed to shoot. America held our hands behind our backs during the Persian Gulf War, if you remember. Which means they brought in their Patriot missiles, they brought in their war army, and Am Yisrael was not allowed to defend themselves. We weren't allowed to pick up a rifle. America fought that war. But how did the Goyim see it? The Israeli aggressor. Even when Am Yisrael is passive and doesn't shoot one bullet, but somehow, whose fault is it always? It's always the Jews' fault. Which means we were out to lunch during that war. We were just catching scuds. And still, whose fault it is? Those Jews in Israel. They caused the whole war. And it's interesting to point out, just as a side point in history, just to show you how everybody looks at it so wrong. Everybody has a convoluted vision of what the truth is. They're all suffering from the same bad eyesight that Balak had. If you remember when Israel went into Iraq on that clandestine mission and took out the nuclear site, of course, that was discussed immediately at an emergency session of the United Nations, the most anti-Semitic institution on the earth. And of course, every country got up and denounced it. But which country was the one that proposed the resolution against Israel for knocking that nuclear reactor out? The minister from the country of Kuwait. Out of all countries, Kuwait. What did Iraq do the next decade to Kuwait? They went in and they attacked Kuwait in order to take their oil fields. Which means Iraq is the enemy of Kuwait. They probably would have used that nuke against them as well. As we see later on in history, what they did to Kuwait. But what does Kuwait come along and say? It's the Jews. Fools, we saved you. We protected you. We did what you were supposed to do. If they had nukes when they went in, they would have nuked the whole Kuwait, taken all the oil fields. So look how history pans out. They all see it. The Jew can never do right. The Jew can only do right when he's killed. Which is only then is the Jew in the right position. When, God forbid, he's in a gas chamber, when he's in a concentration camp, when he's in a work labor camp, then already the Jew is in the right position. But if the Jew is defending his life, already it's wrong. A Jew has no right to defend, and they don't look at it as defending. They look at it as fighting. Do the Palestinians have a right to be in the land of Israel? They're not Israelis. The Palestinians belong in their land, which is either Lebanon, or which is either in Syria. The Jews, out of the goodness of a Jewish heart, allowed them, and now in retrospect we could probably say that that might have been a mistake, but allowed them to be in their country. Since when is it the Jews' responsibility to give nomads of a different country land? And now, not only to give them land, but to give them sovereignty as well. And now even it becomes so confusing that the world has made it that it's the Jews that have been persecuting the Palestinians, even though there has not been one case where an Israeli strapped a bomb against himself and blew up innocent Palestinians. Even though the opposite is true on a daily basis, unfortunately, We're just receiving the attacks, but what's the perception of the world? The Israelis are doing. The Israelis feel they're not doing enough. Only in recent history, that attitude is beginning to change a little. You know what that, when it started to change? When all of a sudden America realized what it means to have an enemy and come attack innocent people. When London started to understand what it means to an Arab to come strap himself up and blow up double-decker buses, now they're starting to understand what it means exactly to be in the Israeli position. But they didn't come around yet. I mean, for some reason, they'll figure out a reason why it's different. Well, you know, when we get attacked, it's different. When Israel gets attacked, they're still wrong. Now, when London gets attacked, it's everybody else's fault. But therefore, for some reason, the Jewish people, they did it to themselves. You know, they caused this, that was the spin doctors seeing it through the eyes of Balak. Vayar Balak, what did he see? He saw the Jews fight Sihon. Tipesh Balak, we didn't fight Sihon. Sihon fought us. We were protecting ourselves. So are we wrong for protecting ourselves and winning? Is that our problem? We didn't want to make a war in the first place. And that's already, you see, the history repeats itself. Even thousands of years later, there is a chidush. It's more than a chidush. It's a truism in life that we learned from this week's parasha. If you remember, when Balak originally engages Bilam, Bilam says, "I can't give you an answer. I need to sleep on it. I need to ask God." God comes to Bilam in the dream, and God tells Bilam, no, go. You can't go. Jewish people are blessed. You're not going to curse the Jewish people. Fine. Bilam comes the next morning, sorry, God said, it's a no-go, I can't do it, impossible. So Balak right away says to himself, alright, listen, I have to sweeten the deal a little. You know, if I throw in some perks, and I throw in some, different lures and attractions, if I maybe offer him some more money, maybe we could, get to change his mind. So it says the next day, Balak comes with more important emissaries, and already comes with a different contract. So Balaam, Rasha, he comes along and says, I'll get back to you. What's to get back to you? I mean, God said no. But the Bilam figures he'll change God's mind. Sure enough, the next night, God comes to Bilam. Bilam says, listen, they want me to go curse. What should I do, God? God tells Bilam, and let's read that inside. I want you to see the Pasuk. Look at Pasuk. Chaf, Pasuk 20. Vayavo Elohim el Bilam laila. God comes to Bilam in the middle of the night. Vayomer lo, he tells him, im lekro lecha ba'u anashim, if the people came to call you, kum lechitam, I go. Yeah? Does this mean that God had a change of mind? I mean, kivyachol, I mean, what happened? The night before, God adamantly tells him, lo telech emmahem. You can't be clearer than that. Don't go with them. And here, just 24 hours later, kivyachol again. God makes a 180. God tells Bilam, listen, if they're calling you, all right, go with them. So that she tells us what happened. That she tells us where God's change of heart, so to speak, came from. Look at Nasi Dibura Matril. Im lekro lecha. If they're calling for you, go with them. Now she says, im akiriya shelcha. If the calling is for you, v'savur ata litor alea sechar. If you think you're going to make some money, they're going to pay you? If it's lecha, you have something to gain? Go. That even makes it more difficult. What, God now all of a sudden became the agent of Bilam? You know, where God's saying, listen, yesterday's deal was a pro bono deal, that's not a good deal. But now they're going to pay you by the hour? I don't like that deal. If they're going to pay, let me see the money you're going to make. Oh, you're going to make this type of money? All right. In the klo lecha. If they're going to give you some in your pocket,
I like it.
Good. The chavod. Since when does God become the negotiator for Bilam to start now, making the decisions based on money? So I heard an explanation from Rav Shimon Schwab. He says like this, it's a lesson in life. He says there's a very, very powerful force in life. And if you have it, you will be successful at whatever your endeavor is. And that force he calls the force of Lishma. Lishma means when people do things idealistically. They do things because they believe in it. They do things because they really understand in their heart, or they believe at least in their hearts, that this is what's supposed to be done. And they don't have any ulterior motives. They're not doing it with an agenda. We might say they're working altruistically, which means they only have the goal in mind because they believe in it. But Shimon Schwab says, be careful of people that are working lishma. Because even if they're working for the wrong cause, but if they have that ingredient of idealism, and they're doing it for the sake of the cause, without ulterior motive, they have a chance to be successful. They have a good chance to be successful. When do projects get ruined? Once already the ulterior motive enters. Once already people start, are interested in the kavod, and they're interested in the politic, and they're interested in the power, and they're interested, then already, the mission is compromised. Already the mission becomes limited. So he says, be careful. Lishma is a powerful force. He gives an example. Example that we know very well. He gives the example, that's one example, but he gives the example of communism. He says the original communists, they believed in that form of government. The original socialists, they believed that this is the antidote of the world. This is going to solve all the world's problems, which means we'll have the division of wealth, there'll be no poverty anymore, everybody will be equal. They thought that they figured out the cure-all to society. This is going to save society from destruction. The original communists, Lenin and Trotsky and Marx, they all had a true belief in the system. He even tells a story about some of the early socialists that he remembers. There was one Jew that was marching in a communist march in Berlin, in Germany, when the party was just beginning. And the kid became an outcast amongst the Jews. You're marching with these guys. He became like, he was a renegade. But what? The kid stood his ground. Because he believed in it. When you saw the original communists, although maybe it wasn't the most popular movement, but they held, this is going to save humanity. They were idealists. Rav Shimon Schwab says that's one of the reasons they were successful. When did communism begin to crumble? When all the heads of the government forgot the original intent. And now there was no longer division of wealth. All the wealth was going to the pockets of the heads of the Politburo, and they were taking all that money and putting in Swiss bank accounts, and now already the lishma of communism was gone. Now already it was for the money. Once already it was for the money, communism collapsed. That's the same story he says happened with Bilam. The night before, Bilam says, they want me to curse. God sees that Bilam is excited to go curse. He wants to do it because he's an anti-Semite and he's lishma. He's doing it because this is what he believes. If you curse Jews, God says, if you're going lishma, you can't go. You can't go with them. The next night, God comes along and says, listen, if they're paying you a lot of money, then you could go. Because if you're doing it for the money, you're not going to be successful. Which is, once already, it's tainted now. Now already you're not doing it because you believe in it. Now already you're doing it to get a check. Now you're doing it to get a check. God, so to speak, says, now I'm not worried about it. Already it's failed. It's doomed to fail before you left the store, before you left the year, before you left the gate, you're doomed to lose. Why? Because already you're doing it for the money. That's a very important lesson on those people, including the speaker, that work for the community. Whether it's in the capacity of rabbinics, or whether it's the capacity of committee, or any other capacity, one always has to remember that to be successful in any endeavor, the overriding and underriding factor must be Leshem Shamayim. As long as the intent of all involved is for the sake of the good, and it's not personal, then already you have a very good chance to succeed. But once already, it becomes personal. You voted against me, now I'm voting against you, and now it's a revenge, and now it's a politic, and now it's an underhand. Or so now already you got lost. Now it's no longer about the issue, now it became about the parties themselves. So now you're not Lishma anymore, you're doing it for the grandeur, you're doing it for the glory, you're doing it for the revenge. Now already, that's a recipe for failure. Those that work in community must always remember the Lishma factor. You can't take your eye off the ball. If you're on a committee of a yeshiva, what's the best interest of the children? It's always about the kids. Yeah, but it's not about you. If it's in the best interest of the children, then it must be done, even if it's going to affect you or offend you. If you're in the synagogue, what's the best situation for the congregants, for the kahal? It's never about kavod and honor and glory. Once that enters the mix, then already it's tainted. Now it's not Lishma anymore. Now it's about polling for position. Now it's about for the power and the honor. Now already, unfortunately, that's the Yetzer Hara gets in and everything falls apart. That's what God was telling Bilam. You're going because you hate Jews, you can't go. You believe in the project, they don't go because you're going to be successful. If you're going for yourself, because they filled your pockets with money, God said, not worry, go with them. You don't know how much you're going to fail miserably. We know the end of the story. Along the same lines, I'll tell you a story that happened with the great rabbi of Itzel from Penevich. He tells a story where once the committee got together from the institution, maybe it was the yeshiva or whatever it was, and the members of the committee were supposed to discuss a certain thing on the agenda. Certain things were supposed to be brought up. And the members of the committee got into a heated verbal debate. And right away the first group gets up, the contributors, and they say, you know, we should be running the meeting over here. We should be setting the agenda. After all, we're the money. We're giving the money. We should have the strongest voice. All of a sudden, the elders of the group get up and say, so we have seniority over here. We're the oldest members over here. We're the veterans. We should be running the meeting. And all of a sudden, you have the officials. They get up and say, what do you mean? We're the officials of the community. Now already each guy's saying why they should have a right to talk first. The rich guy says, I should talk first. The older guy says, he should talk first. And the official members come along and say, they should talk first. Now the rabbi is there trying to get order. So he comes along and says, Rabotai, let me explain this to you. He says, the story is told that the donkeys came in front of God. And the donkeys came along and said, it's not fair. Why can't we be like all other animals? All other animals, they roam the desert freely. They have no stress. They have no anxiety. The cow, they just, take milk from him once a day, and they let him roam the field, eat grass all day long. The sheep, once in a while, they shear him, and they let him go freely. But me, the master works me all day long. The hamor works harder than any other animal. And I have no defense, I have no break. So he says, it's not fair. So the donkey asked God, give me a chance to speak. If you give me a chance to speak, then I will be able to tell my master, please, lighten up, I'm tired. So God told the donkey, fine, I'm going to give you one chance to speak. And who was that? He said that was the donkey of Bilam. The donkey of Bilam, when he was riding on the donkey, the angel now came in front of the donkey. So Bilam wasn't able to go straight. The donkey veered to the right, veered to the left, crushed his legs. So now he starts to hit his donkey. So instead of the donkey opening his mouth and saying, what are you hitting me for? There's an angel in the way. The donkey comes along and opens his mouth and he starts to tell how important he is. I'm the donkey, I never did anything wrong, I took care of you. So the rabbi said, once the donkey got a chance to open his mouth and he started to talk about himself, then God said, you blew it, you lost the right to talk. And then he turned to all those officials and said, all you guys are getting up along and claiming that you have a right to talk because you're a contributor, and you have a right to talk because you're a seniority, and you're... He says, you lost your right to talk. Anybody that gets up and talks about their right and how great they are and how important they are, finished. You've abused your power of speech and you've lost your right, continue talking. Hence the rabbi was saying, you're just like the Hamor of Bilam. God gave him a chance to talk, was the first thing that comes out of his mouth. I'm a good donkey, I took care of you. What are you talking? Just tell me there's an angel in front of him. Who asked you to start giving a speech about self-praise? Once the Hamor opened his mouth in self-praise, God said, you blew it. You don't have a right to talk anymore. When the fellow on the committee got up and started to talk about self-praise, you abused it. Sit down. You relinquished your right to speak. And that's the lesson again. Number one, not to self-praise oneself. And number two, the importance of being Nishma. One more Hiddush that we'll say towards the end of the Parasha. In the blessings themselves of Bilam, one of the things he said was, Natovu Ohanecha Yaakov Ishkenotecha Yisrael. Such a beautiful blessing that our custom is that at our weddings we usher in the bride and groom under the chuppah singing Matovu Ohanecha Yaakov Ishkenotecha Yisrael. It's ironic that a pasuk that Bilam intended as a curse not only turned into a blessing, but it turned into a blessing that we use at the most momentous of our occasions. Had Bilam known that one of his poems are going to be sung a thousand of times at the weddings, you know, that's a bigger punishment to Bilam. It's not enough that you cursed us, but you coined, you know, the official wedding song for every single Jewish wedding in Klal Yisrael. That's already a double burn for Bilam over there. You know, it wasn't a one. He didn't realize that he just coined the bestseller. Like it was in the top 10 in Matovu Ohanecha Yaakov. And who's the author? You got to give the credits to Bilam. And Bilam's the author. The Gemara says that all the blessings of Bilam eventually turned into curses. Listen to this Gemara. All the positive things that he said, you can read those same pisukim and read them in a negative connotation, and the Gemara says they all came true in a negative way as well. Except for Matovu Ohanecha Yaakov, how beautiful are your tents, Israel, Mishkenotecha Yisrael. All the other berachot changed to Kelalot, except for Matovu. It's interesting. They tell a story of Rav Levi Yitzhak Miberdichev. He says about himself that once he had a out-of-body experience. You know, his neshama went up to heaven, and he saw that in heaven they made a decree that all the Jewish people are going to become wealthy as of today. Levi Yitzhak couldn't believe it. This is amazing breaking news. The fifth, there's not going to be poverty anymore. So he asked the group there, who proposed this idea? So they say the Satan. Satan himself. So the Levi Yitzhak Miberdishev comes along and says, if the Satan himself made that idea, it must be bad. And therefore, he lobbied to repeal it. Which means, from the Satan, no good ideas are coming from the Satan. Which means, if he said everybody should become rich, rest assured, it's going to be bad for us. So he said the same thing with Balaam. He said, all the good things that he says from a bad guy, it's got to turn sour. So they asked him, they said, yeah, but Matovu Alecha, they said that was the exception. He said, even Matovu Alecha. They said, why? What could be so bad? How beautiful are your tents, Israel? So he said like this. Well, he said, or based on this, they said, what was the difference between the true Jewish prophets and the false prophets? The basic difference between the Navi Emet and the Navi Sheker is not the words that they told in their prophecies, because obviously the words are different, but one constant difference between them is that the Jewish prophets always would prophesy rebuke and chastisement, and the false prophet would always prophesy everything's going to be okay. The false prophet never prophesies doom and destruction. The false prophet always says, worry about it, it's not going to happen, everything's fine, you're good. And it's always the real prophet, the Isaiahs of the world, the Yirmiyahs of the world, they were always coming along and saying, be careful, it's getting serious, it's going to happen, it's coming, the destruction. And you got the false prophets on the other side, these guys are alarmists. Don't pay no attention to them. That's their job. They're prophets. They have to scare you. They're exaggerating. Don't take it so seriously. Throughout history, the false prophet always gives the people a false sense of security that everything's going to be okay. We're better off hearing chastisement from true prophets than hearing appeasement from false prophets. That's obvious. Even though nobody wants to hear rebuke, but at least that motivates us to repent, to become better, and to change our ways. But when we hear how great we are, that only lulls us into complacency. That only causes us to let our guard down. We're good, everything's okay. Balaam comes along and says, Matovu Alecha Yisrael, you guys are great. Your tents are beautiful. Mishkenotecha Yisrael. Am Yisrael, you're beautiful. What's the nature of a person when he hears how great he is? Comes along and says, oh, I'm so great, so I can relax. And therefore, the rabbi said, even Matovu Alecha Yaakov can be explained in the negative way. Balaam saw if he can't curse us or praise us to death. Praising us to death also has a downside to it. Because if a person hears his praises so much, so then already they have a tendency to lighten up. Shlomo HaMelech said, better to hear a rebuke than a praise. The guy who hears rebuke will change. The guy that hears praise can only fall into pitfalls. But I want to explain, with your permission, and I'll conclude with this, the interpretation of the Ketav Sofer on this. He said that when they installed him as the rabbi, I think maybe it was in Prague, so when he got there, he says, besides the main synagogue, there was 100 smaller synagogues, satellite synagogues throughout Prague. And the Ketav Sofer didn't like it. He said, instead of everybody praying together, Berov Amad Lat Melech, we believe the more the merrier. When the big Kahal prays together, it's a greater praise of God. Instead of everybody praying in their own synagogue. And of course, when he discussed it with the people, he said, oh, more synagogue, it's beautiful, it's beracha. But he really understood that the source of all these synagogues was really that there was disunity in the community. As happens. And you start off with one synagogue, and then, you know, there's factions. These guys don't like the way the Hazan is going too fast, he's going too slow. So the Hazan guys make their own shul, they get their own Hazan. And then that shul, they come along now, they don't like the rabbi. So they got another faction. You know, so they got the rabbis now. So they split up. So it's like the Mekah of frogs in Egypt. You know, it starts off with one big frog, and then you hit it and it turns into two frogs. So that's what happens with synagogues also. You all start off as one, and then the factions, and you see you're splitting a half, and a half becomes a quarter becomes an eighth, and it keeps on splitting. So the community was coming along and saying, oh, how beautiful, all these synagogues in Prague. The Tzatzofer says, don't be wise guys over here. These synagogues over here didn't come from Berach. Ah, this came over here because there were so many fights in the community. So therefore, no 10 Jews were able to pray with another 10 Jews. So each guy had to open up his own, shtiebel. He had to open up his own minyan. He says, and now you made it understood to me what the Gemara meant, that all the curse, all the blessings of Bilaam reverted into curses except Matovu Alecha. What does Matovu Alecha mean? Bilaam was saying, how beautiful your tents are. Mishkenotecha Yisrael. What is he referring to? The synagogues. Kohen, Mishkan, how beautiful are your synagogues? So he says, that never turned into a curse. You know why? Because it was a curse from the beginning. Which is all the other ones, he said, they were a bit at least at one point. And then they turned into a curse. Except for Matovu, that was the curse of the beginning. When Bilaam saw all the synagogues all around the city, he said, how beautiful is this? Look at all the disunity. Look at all the mahloket. Look at all these people that don't know how to coexist with each other, that they can't pray in one place. They gotta go split up. In Bilaam's world, this is Matovu. This is something that's noteworthy. Bilaam got excited. So the Gemara is saying, you didn't have to turn that into a curse. Because it was a curse from when he said it. It started off as a Gemara. And that's a great lesson as well. Our community for many years, until today, we pride ourselves on that one fact. That it's a unified community. And as splintered as we think we are, compared to other communities, we still can boast a tremendous amount of unity amongst this people and cohesiveness. That being said, however, there is something to talk about the divisiveness that still exists and might be widening in the community, whether it's in synagogues themselves or in communities of themselves. We have different factions, different types of communities, etc. So that is something to be concerned about, that it's not always a blessing when you see Jews scattered across the city. If the source of the scattering is because they can't get along, then it's actually the curse of Bilaam Matovu Ohalecha. In Bilaam's eyes, that's already the biggest blessing when Jews are disunited and there is no cohesive bond. What Allah should bless us, that we should go back to the old way, where Am Yisrael will be Berev Echad Ki Ish Echad, where our community will enjoy peace amongst themselves, whether it's in the families and in the larger picture, their communities. Adonai Oz La'amo Yiten, Adonai Yibarech Et Amo, Bashalom, Adonai Yabarech Hashem.